Welcome to the Death Doula Duo. I'm Sarah Kovash.
I'm Jennifer O'Neill.
And this is where we explore the profound mysteries of life and all things death. Hello. Welcome to the Death Doula Duo. I am Sarah Kovash and my co-host here.
I am Jennifer O'Neill. We are very excited to have our guest, Dr. Nassar, who is the head of hospice at St. Anthony's, and along with many other titles I've learned after talking with him for an hour. And so we're very excited to have him on the show today.
Yes, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm a nurse at St. Anthony's, and that's how I met Dr. Nassar. And so I just wanted to, you know, introduce this, the subject of hospice, because it's such an important aspect of end-of-life care. And as I was looking just on the hospice website, one of the things that hospice says is that many people actually live longer under hospice care because their symptoms are managed, they're treated based on their needs and preferences, and their quality of life improves. And I know that a lot of people have a lot of misconceptions about that. So I'm excited to, you know, get some information out. And I'd love to ask you your story about how you became involved with hospice. And, you know, I know you were one of the pioneers, so.
Yeah, if you could just give us your whole bio also.
I'm board certified in family medicine. That's what I do for a living. And about a little bit over 30 years ago, it was a very accidental or something happened, just the work of God. I was in the office seeing patient when a lady walked into my office, introduced herself, and her name was Margaret Back. This lady was the director of a hospice in Oklahoma City, and I didn't know what hospice is. She walked into my office and she said, we would like you to be our medical director. And I said, what is hospice? What is this? She said, don't worry, we'll teach you what hospice is. So she told me that in a couple of months, we have a meeting, a conference in Tampa, Florida, and we'd like you to go. So I was so excited. I figured this is a free vacation and I'm going to go and attend that that meeting for only 1 hour and then run away and go to Busch Garden.
Go to the beach.
And take my son, at that time, was I had only one son at a time, and my wife, and have a good time. I went to Tampa, Florida. I walked in, and we were staying in a very nice hotel, very nice facility, and there was a nice conference room. But I walked into that room, and I sat down in the back, hoping that it would be maybe 30 to 45 minutes, and I would leave. The first speaker was... It was an unforgettable meeting to me. The first speaker was Dr. Alex Peralta. Alex Peralta is an internist from Texas, from Dallas. He was one of my mentors, was one of the people that I connected with later on. And he spoke for a few minutes about hospice and introduced the second speaker, who was Dr. Josefina Magno. Josefina Magno starts talking. And by the end of the presentation, which took about 30 minutes, and the presentation of Dr. Peralta, actually, which he carried on afterwards, I was glued to the chair. And I moved from the back to the front. And I told my wife to go to Busch Garden by herself with the child. Aww. It was like somebody introduced me to a new religion. It was an extremely powerful meeting. The one of you who don't know who Dr. Magno is, Dr. Magno is one of the founder of hospice movement in the country. She was the lady who introduced hospice to the Congress to become a Medicare benefit.
Can you say her name again?
Josefina Magno.
Thank you.
She's originally from the Philippines. She's an oncologist by training. She herself had breast cancer. She went through a period where she faced the reality of death and dying, and she dealt with it, and she decided this is her message. And she left oncology to focus on palliative care and hospice care in this country. And she was the founder of a hospice in Virginia. In order to learn more, she flew to England, and she learned directly from the founder of hospice movement in the world, Cicely Sanders. The meeting itself in Tampa, let's go back to Tampa, was really fascinating. And the part that captured my soul and my heart was the way they were talking about hospice. Because I'm a healer. I get patients to my office to get them well. I see them. I order tests to get them well and go back to their life, to normal life. But then I found out that I am lacking a lot, because we sometimes get to the point, and frequently rather, get to the point where the patient comes and say, what else can you do for me? And the conventional answer, there's nothing I can do for you. Hospice is definitely an alternative to that. And the answer to that would be, there's nothing I can do for you to cure you, but I can do a lot to keep you comfortable and work with you hand by hand through that journey. If you allow me, I can tell you the story that left me in tears, that was presented by Dr. Peralta.
Yes, that'd be great.
It's a very powerful story. Very helpful. He is talking about one of his own patients. It was a 7-year-old child, and my son was at the same age at the time, who had leukemia. And he was pretty much dying. And Dr. Peralta was visiting him on a regular basis. He lived in a small middle-class home. His room was a small room, child room. And his bed was facing the wall, and the back of his bed is behind it, there's a window. So when the kid is laying down, he sees nothing but the wall in front of him. So Alex Peralta, Dr. Peralta, walked into that room, and he saw the mother was crying. Obviously, she was holding her child hand and in tears. And he asked her, how is he doing? She said to him, he is hallucinating. He's getting confused. He doesn't know what he's doing. And Alex asked her, what do you mean by that? She said, he's looking at the wall, and he's telling me that there are kids calling him to go and play with him. Alex is a very spiritual guy. He looked at her, and he almost had tears in his eyes, and he said to her, if he asks you again, tell him, please, you can go.
Yeah, I just got chills all over my body.
Yeah, you've brought me to tears.
The next day, this is exactly what happened. And the mother told him, yes, honey, you can go and play with the kids. A few minutes later, he was gone. He was with God. The moral of the story, this is a child who was asking his mother a permission to leave. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many Kleenex I used after that story when I was in that meeting. And that's when I decided, this is my new religion. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take care of people. I'm going to make him transition to the next life peacefully. I want them to have a very, very smooth landing.
That's beautiful.
So that's my story with hospice.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. That's a beautiful story.
So that is a great example of a good death. And that was actually one of the things that I wanted to ask you about. And I'm sure you've gotten to see a lot of those situations. I'm getting that, you know, making a difference is really what called you, that you wanted to do.
I really appreciate that story. Can you share some of the common fears that people have surrounding or the misconceptions about hospice?
Yes. One of the most important thing that a misconception that people have about hospice, that it's a death sentence. It's hasten death. We go on hospice and we really give them medicine so they will die. That's absolutely not true. Exactly the opposite. As you said earlier, and you commented about the life expectancy on hospice versus no hospice. And fascinating you said that. And there is a study that was done in 2007 in Ocala, Florida, a retrospective cohort study, which means they studied roughly 4,500 patients, dividing them. Half of them did not have hospice, and the other half had hospice. And they followed that study for 3 years. And they found out a fascinating finding. And I have it here, so I can't remember the exact numbers. So people with lung cancer on hospice lived 279 days versus 240 days without hospice. People with pancreatic cancer, they live 211 days as opposed to 189 days without hospice. Prostate cancer, these are the common cancers that they studied, 514 versus 510. And breast cancer, 422 versus 410. So hospice care increased the life expectancy because it provide a continuous follow-up and focus and attention on the patient and the family and meeting their needs. So that's definitely improved the quality of life. The other part of the misconception is people think that hospice care means no care. Oh, you cannot have a CAT scan. You cannot have an X. That's absolutely not true. Yes, we eliminate the unnecessary testings or things that done without a clear objective, without any meaning, mm-hmm. without leading to a purpose, okay? So and say, okay, let's have a CAT scan so I can find out what's going on. Why? What is the purpose? Is that going to change the plan? Isn't that a burden on the person, taking them to the hospital and put them through the CAT scan?
Sure.
Not to mention the cost and the inconvenience and all the trauma that associated with that. Yeah. So this is another factor.
Mm-hmm. And so what can help people know when they're at that time where they have that choice? And I know there's a lot of conversations with their healthcare providers and specialists, and I know some of the work that you're doing on that with talking to the specialists also about those conversations. This may be a twofold question, but what have you been able to have conversations with specialists and surgeons that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is really a big challenge. Physicians in general try to avoid that. And for several reasons. And let me tell you, first of all, it's a very stressful task. And it's time consuming because people have to sit down and explain things. They think in their mind, that some of the physicians think, by telling the patient you're going to be on hospice, I'm telling them there will be no hope. So taking away the hope from the patient, which is, you can't give a false hope. The other feeling that they experience or the thoughts that they think about is maybe offering hospice will damage the relationship between me and the patient. One more thing, which is very important, physicians in general have a certain level of ego. We all know that. And they feel this is a failure. If I tell the patient, okay, you're going to have to be on hospice, that means I'm failing. I cannot cure you.
That is exactly the word I was thinking of, is that they might be seen as a failure or fear that.
Yeah, I think that most people in the medical field in that regard are there to help you get better, or help save you in some way. And by putting you on hospice, you're admitting that that's not possible anymore. And so that can be very hard to accept.
But you know what? That leads us to the process. How do you get to that point? First of all, I always advise my fellow physicians, start the conversation as early as possible in the process. You see, this patient has been admitted several times to the hospital and there's no improvement. And as a matter of fact, there is decline. Mm-hmm. Start the conversation early and never, ever talk about this when the patient in crisis. This is when the patient becomes vulnerable. They don't know how, they cannot make the right decision. They cannot absorb the information. You do it gradually on a regular basis. This is what medical practice is all about, having that special relationship between them and their patients, okay? So I advise the physician to, when you start that conversation, taking into consideration the following. Number one, have all the facts in front of you. Do not say, oh yeah, I think we did that CAT scan and I don't remember. That destroys your credibility. So you really have to have all the facts. You have to be prepared. You have to be prepared not in terms of information or the data you have about the patient, but also you have to be prepared time-wise. Mm-hmm. You have to know that this is a time-consuming process. You cannot sit down and say it, make that talk about that, and move into that conversation for 5 minutes or 10 minutes. You really have to designate a reasonable period of time to discuss that.
That's good.
This is so important because physicians are in a hurry and they say, okay, well, let's talk on this. And they keep looking at their watch when they're talking and they're ready to leave the room. This is absolutely the wrong way to talk about that, okay? So these are very important elements in introducing the patients to the facts. The other important question that the patient always, and the physician has always to ask the patients is, it's a precious question. It's, to me, it's a $1 million question. What are your goals? What do you want? You have incurable cancer, okay? You are not improving based on all the treatment that we gave you already. What are your goals? You'll be amazed how peaceful that will be to them. They will tell you exactly. They go through that process. Mm-hmm. And they will tell you, we want to die peacefully at home, mm-hmm, with our family. There are three things older people in general fear the most, particularly patients who are facing their death. Number one is pain. Mm-hmm. Hospice, tell them 100%, I am definitely, positively sure that I will do everything I can to prevent you from having pain and manage your pain and other symptoms as well. Remember, not only pain. Number two, loneliness. Hospice doesn't leave you alone. Take care of you. They'll be available for you in addition to your family and your loved one and your caretakers. Thirdly, which is extremely important, loss of control. Hospice, keep you in control. You are in control.
Just that question puts them in control, mm-hmm, of, yes, being able to decide.
You
want to
have breakfast at 10 o'clock in the evening, you better believe it, you will have it. Yeah. You want your medication in a certain time, you will get it. They are in control. So this is to me, it's the ultimate care, you know?
Yeah. So what do you feel like prevents people from wanting to even talk about the end of life?
Lack of education, lack of knowledge, these are two major factors. We face that a lot with family and family members. The other factor is sometimes, you know, you love your mom is have cancer, advanced cancer, so you want her to be alive. You want her to not, you don't want her to die. So what do? You start negotiating. How about if we send her to MD Anderson? How about if we go to Mayo Clinic? Does that make any difference? So they start negotiating, they start, you know, becoming like a subject of maybe bargaining, if you will. So lack of education is really the main factor, in my opinion.
I can appreciate that. I feel like that really is the barrier to proper end-of-life care and after death care, especially.
Let me tell you a story. This is really fascinating. It proved to you that some people don't get informed, and it's so sad. I was walking in the hospital, back 2 years back, and I heard a lady, middle-aged lady. She looks like she's from the country. You know, she's coming from somewhere out of the city, holding a phone and talking to somebody. And she said exactly that word by word. Honey, don't worry. It's not cancer. It's leukemia. that shocked me. That really shocked me. That person did not know anything about their disease. Somebody walked into the room and say, oh, your husband or your wife or your mom or your dad has leukemia. And they have no clue what that is. So lack of knowledge is so important.
How do you think that we can close the gap on that lack of knowledge?
That's an excellent question. There are actually several factors. What you're doing now is one of them. Educate people, educate physicians, educate the public. Talk about this openly. Mm-hmm. Make people understand there is an alternative to suffering. Mm-hmm. End-of-life care can be peaceful, can be good. Euthanasia is not an option in our society, mostly in our society here in Oklahoma. The further you educate people, the more they make them understand what we do, the more likely they will agree with what we're doing, and they will probably request that kind of service. Now, it's really interesting. One of the things that I noticed during my practice that most of the patients who come and say, would you please admit my father to hospice? They had experience with their mother. She was on hospice and they had a wonderful experience, and they didn't realize what kind of wonderful service they had. So sometimes word of mouth can be also personal experience can lead them to believe in that type of service.
Yeah, just helping people realize they have choices at all can really help. Well, what advice would you give to individuals that are going through this of what they could do either for themselves or for their loved ones, like asking questions to their healthcare provider or?
This is a great question. This is what I do with my patients when they go and see the oncologist, for example. Because oncologist is classic action. Their action is to try one therapy after another. They do their job. That's their interest and their intention is to keep that patient alive. And that's good. That's a noble cause. However, they lack a very important piece of information when they do that. They never tell the patient, with this chemotherapy, you're going to be throwing up probably 20 hours a day. You're going to lose your hair. And you're going to be having significant dizziness. And you'll feel miserable, but they never say, okay, how does that impact my life expectancy? And if they ask them that, they will say 3 months. Now it's up to the patient to decide, is it worth it to go through that
for
3 months of living? Mm-hmm. Do you want to die until you die, or do you want to live until you die? This is the question.
That is exactly the question.
Yeah. And they have to make the choice. And I respect the patient's choice. The patient has the autonomy. They say, oh, okay, I want to live as many days as possible, and I will take any kind of treatment. So be it. That's fine. Believe me, most of them, they change their mind afterwards. Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm. If not all of them. The vast majority of them, they do.
I think a lot of them start out wanting to fight because they think that's what they're supposed to do. They think that's the right thing to do.
Or they think that that's going to make things better.
Yes.
Without realizing that actually they may just be running around and doing all these things, trying to gain more days, but then they're never able to just sit and have a day.
And often the family has influence in that choice too. I think a lot of people may choose that at the jest of their family. You know, their family wants them to fight, so they may make those choices that they wouldn't have otherwise chosen.
This is an excellent point. That's why I always advocate for the family to be present during that conversation. That's the part I missed. I did not mention earlier. You have to have the family, all the caretaker or the essential family members in that room during that conversation. Let me tell you, for several reasons. Number one, so they will be part of that process. Decision-making process. Mm-hmm. Of course, the final decision is the patient's decision.
Right.
Number two, they absorb the information better than a patient. Let me tell you something. I'll give you an example. Mm-hmm. I walk into the room And there is, I want to break the bad news to a patient. I want to tell him the biopsy came back and it's pancreatic cancer. Okay. I walk into the room and I look at the patient and say, Mr. Jones, the biopsy came back. It is positive for pancreatic cancer. And then if I talk after that for 10 or 15 minutes, he will never hear a word of that. Mm-hmm. He is already in a different world. Mm-hmm. He's thinking about his family, his affair, his
His life's flashing before his eyes.
His children, his grandchildren, his funeral arrangement. Mm-hmm. He is not with you. Mm-hmm. So having a family members, and obviously this is not a way to break news. Obviously, I have to. There's a style in breaking the bad news, and I give lectures about this.
Oh, you do? That's amazing.
Absolutely. This is a very important topic.
I agree.
And I try to teach it to medical students and residents and also to physicians how to break the bad news. So back to the subject, the family and the essential members of the family who are caretakers or part of the decision-making process for that patient should be in the room during that conversation.
That's good information. I'm really glad that you remember to bring that up, because family is really important in general, especially regarding the end of life.
Before we finish here, let me say something. You hear the word good death. Mm-hmm. There is such thing as good death.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Good death is you're transitioning to the next life, where this is a precious time where love can be expressed, forgiveness can be extended or received, where relationship can be fixed and mend. Mm-hmm. It's a precious time. Don't underestimate the value of that time. And you can't imagine how much the family appreciate what we do when we finish the job effectively. And as I said earlier, we have a smooth landing. It is so important.
I think, yeah, you brought up a great point, because providing that time to the family is one of the biggest goals, I think, of just good end-of-life care and providing that.
Thank you, Dr. Nassar. Dr. Nassar, on a good death, thank you for being here. We appreciate you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us as we journey through life's most enigmatic reality. I'm Jennifer O'Neill.
And I'm Sarah Kovash.
And we are
the Death Doula Duo.
The Death Doula Duo is brought to you by the Possibilities Podcast platform.
If you have comments, suggestions, or would like to be on the show, please email us at thedeathdouladuo@gmail.com. Until next time, may all your discussions about death be lively.